From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Anthony Swafford served in the first Gulf War. He was a Marine Scout sniper. He wrote a searing book about his experience, Jarhead. It became a bestseller, taught us a lot about war, was made into a movie with Jake Gyllenhaal playing Swafford. Pretty heady stuff. But the Jarhead at home, Swafford, was spinning. Drugs, alcohol, depression, divorce, wasted money, and lots of women. Swafford could not find his way, thought about suicide, struggled to make a relationship with another vet, his father. This hour on Point, a Marine, a Jarhead long back from war, and the road at home. You can join the conversation. Is this your story? Did you survive war and then flounder stateside? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's a little bit from the film 2005, Jarhead, based on Anthony Swafford's 2003 bestseller, where he, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, talks about what the Marines do well and where the Marines fall short.
For most problems, the Marine is issued a solution. If ill, go to sick bay. If wounded, call corpsman. If dead, report to Graves Registration. If losing his mind, however, no standard solution exists.
Jake Gyllenhaal playing Anthony Swafford in Jarhead. No standard solution for coming home, either. Joining me from New York is Anthony Swafford. His first book was Jarhead, a Marine's Chronicle of the Gulf War and Other Battles, about his time as a Marine in the First Gulf War. Mark Bowden, author of Black Hawk Down, called it one of the best books ever written about military life, the most honest memoir he'd read from our time's wars, he said. It was made into that 2005 film. Anthony Swafford is with us. His new book is Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails, a Memoir. Anthony Swafford, welcome. Thanks for being with us here again.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So I open this up and start to read in here, and I know your war was a long time ago, and there's a lot of miles since then, but it opens up sounding kind of like a bad James Bond joke. I mean, you've got cocaine and martinis and fancy sport cars and cases of Burgundy in your Rolex dive watch and rafts of women, but not exactly happy. What happened to you?
Well, I was still fighting a bit of a war inside my head, and just like my father had before me,
Vietnam,
and in coming back from Vietnam, and the transition is always difficult, and mine was maybe harder than some. We used to joke when I was in the Marines that it would take 5 years for us to get over the brainwashing that we'd gone through, but for some guys it takes longer, and some guys never really get over it.
Harder than some, and I guess I wonder why. You were there for the Gulf War. It was a short war. It was a war that ended, the sort of flaming of it was triumph. There were parades back home and all the rest. What is it, 15 days or something like that of active combat? You weren't killed. You didn't kill. Why so hard coming home?
Well, I say in the early pages of the book that I share something with my father, and I share it with other combat veterans. And in the last decade, I've spent a lot of time around veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan. And there's something that everyone who comes home has in common, and that's this this excited feeling that you came very close to dying, because when you're at combat, you always mm-hmm. might die, but you lived, and it's intoxicating. But it's also dangerous because you can't continue to live with that excitement and that glorious feeling. You also come back with feelings of hypervigilance. And when you're in the military, even if you don't like a guy, you can always trust him. You can most likely trust him because you've trained with him. You know how he's going to perform. He knows how you're going to perform. And back in the civilian world, it just doesn't work that way. You tend to not be able to count on very many people. And that's difficult for the veteran to deal with, and it was difficult for me to deal with. And, some guys come back and, they become math teachers and fit in and don't have a problem with it, and others don't. And there's no, I don't know that the length of war, the severity of war really matters. I think, you know, being at combat changes a person. And even just serving, even in peacetime, changes a person. It's preparing for war and setting up a combatant's mindset that is hard to come down from.
Was it harder for you or easier because war itself, and your very frank telling of it, became your claim to fame? I mean, you write in the front piece of the new book, Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails, you write, quoting Thomas Bernard from Gathering Evidence, "War is the poetry of men by which they seek to gain attention and relief throughout their lives." I mean, talk about hanging your hat on it. There was Jarhead, not just a bestseller, but a movie, Jake Gyllenhaal, all the rest. Did that make it harder for you, or what did it mean?
I do think it made it harder. I had spent my 20s in some ways attempting to simply forget that I had been in the Marine Corps and gone to the Gulf War, and you know, getting my education, getting my bachelor's degree, getting my master's degree, and trying to walk away from that world. And then I wrote this book that completely disallowed me the walking away from that life and defined me as a Marine, you know, as a Jarhead, as I call us in the book. And so I was then unable to not be that guy who'd written the memoir about the Gulf War. And, you know, there was no way I could walk away from the reality of that and the reality of my service.
Sex, drugs, rock and roll, and that memory, that reality, all there, and very much in this book. There's a little bit from early on in the book I wish you'd read for us, talking about yourself and your dad, it turns out, with whom you shared a bunch of road trips many miles in a Winnebago. We'll look at that complicated relationship. But just the way this personal history came in, even very much to the most intimate parts of your life. Could you read for us some there, Anthony?
Absolutely. And this is from the prologue. "Like many combat veterans I know, my father and I lived with the wickedly exciting and doggedly exhausting knowledge that we had once, for a short period of time, flirted with death and won. This knowledge is like a drug, the purest cocaine or 80-year-old Highland single malt scotch. Once you have had some, it alters your understanding of the world and of other people and of consequences. If I lied to a lover about what neighborhood or city or country I'd slept in the night before, it didn't really matter. The relationship might sour, but she would never kill me. Lying about sex became fun. It became a hobby. Manhattan bored me, drinking bored me, drugs bored me, but lying about sex never bored me. Eventually, I had wasted such a massive amount of money on women, wine, drugs, cars, and booze, that my dissipation and deceit blew up in my face. I looked up one day and could no longer afford the mortgage on my apartment. I had to sell and became, in a way, homeless. I would have liked to ask my father for advice, but at the time, our relationship was in complete disrepair. But for some time, my father had owned a Winnebago and a dream, that we two traverse the country and come to an understanding and discover a friendship. One trip wasn't enough. Neither was two. It took three."
Two vets in a Winnebago, and they were father and son, and it was a fraught relationship. Anthony Swofford reading from his new book, Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails, a memoir. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. We've got veterans calling in, and I want to get to them, but introduce us to the big vet in your life, your early life in particular, your dad.
Yeah, my father, I was conceived when my father was on leave from Vietnam. My mother got a phone call one Friday afternoon, and an Air Force sergeant told her to be in Honolulu the next day. And she met my father for his 5 days off from the war. And I was the result of that. So I always thought of myself as a war baby and intimately connected to that fact in my father's life. And my father was a lifer in the military and retired when I was about 12 years old. But I always knew that he'd been a vet, that he'd served in Vietnam, and occasionally friends from his Vietnam vet friends would come over. And when they did, the men would huddle in the family room and talk quietly and wouldn't really share with the rest of the family whatever conversation was happening. And as a very curious kid, I knew that there was something elemental to my father that was being discussed.
Difficult relationship. I mean, you really had trouble with this guy. And you trace it back to his, in some ways, to his own war experience.
I do. You know, he was a difficult father, and he was occasionally physically abusive. And, you know, he ran the house as though we were a platoon of military people.
Philandering, say, hard drinking and tough on your mother and you, the kids.
Yeah, very, very tough on us kids, you know, very discipline-oriented, checklists for our daily lives, and which caused there to be two different homes that we lived in. And there was the home when my father was gone at work, which was kind of freewheeling and light, as my mother was, and then the home that would happen when my father returned, which was radically different, and that's... that was a home that had a lot of fear coursing through it, because the goal of every day was to not upset our father. And it took many years. I mean, it took decades for us to come together and find a place for all of that history.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Jarhead author, ex-Marine Anthony Swofford, scout sniper in the Gulf War, about life after war and his winding road to kind of personal peace. His new book is Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails, a memoir. He shares a lot of that memoir with his father, a Vietnam War era veteran. Anthony Swofford joins us from New York. Anthony, in those Winnebago road trips all across the country, what did your dad want? He was terminally ill and old and kind of let go of a lot of his vices by this point. Not all, but a lot. What did he want from you?
Yeah, my father was pretty vice-free at this point. He was in his late 60s and sick with emphysema. And I have to give my father a lot of credit because he did something that I don't think a lot of fathers do, and that was he made the first move. He made the first gesture toward reconciliation by asking me to go on this initial RV trip with him, which was a trip from Northern California to Missoula, Montana. And, I thought he might just want a co-driver, but we were about 10 hours into the road trip, and I'd been doing most of the driving, and it was late at night, and I was at the wheel. And I don't know if you've ever driven a Winnebago, but it's kind of a scary thing, a 44-footer especially.
Huge dimensions, yeah.
Yeah, it's like driving in your own little earthquake. But in the middle of the night, my dad reached over from the passenger seat and grabbed my arm and said, "Hey, son, I think we need to clear the air. There are some things we need to talk about," which was, the understatement of the decade. That one trip didn't fix our relationship. I had an older brother who passed away in the late 90s, and my father's behavior around my brother's death did not sit well with me. He didn't attend the funeral, which
your brother died young, cancer in his 30s, and your dad didn't show up. Why?
I thought he was a coward. My brother did die at the age of 35 with a wife and two children, and I guess my father was too wrapped up in his own mourning to show up for the rest of the family, and I judged him heavily for that, and I couldn't let it go. But my father... Again, I have to give him credit because he gave me the venue for letting it go. He would call it venom. He would say, my father's Southern and has a way with storytelling and words, and he would say, "Tone, you need to get your venom out. It's not for me. I'm going to die soon, but it's for you. You need to move on, and you're not going to move on if you haven't gotten rid of this venom." And so I said a lot of things to my father that I don't think he wanted to hear, and I said some things that he probably disagrees with. We went back and forth on these trips, and we argued and we fought, and there were long silences.
Just a little reading you might do for us, Anthony. I think it's 2:30 or so. You talk about the RV, the Winnebago, as a truth machine. Could you dip in there?
Yeah, I'd love to. I began to think of the RV as a truth machine, a narrative machine, like a photo booth but better, a story booth. the story of my father, and I realize that he, too, must feel this way. Story equals truth, and truth equals forgiveness. Driving along America's roads on each trip, we talked, and our mouths were spades, digging toward truth. He wanted me to forgive him, and he wanted to go back to the beginning of time. It was naive of me not to have recognized that part of my father's RV dream. His desire for constant motion was the wish to slow life down inside that machine, to stop time, to stop the decline of his health, to stop his aging, even to stop his own death and the death of his family. Drive faster, drive farther, and you will cure all that ails you, I can hear him telling himself. And you might even bring Jeff back to life.
Jeff, the brother who had died in his 30s, Anthony Swofford there, driving with his fellow veteran from two different wars in hotels, hospitals, and jails. That father who you write, truthfully, the man was a real bastard, you say, that you spent most of your life in childhood in fear of him, but you were looking here to become a loving son. Did it matter that you were two veterans in that RV?
Yeah, it being a veteran defines both of us. And his truth about Vietnam was something that he would only share in parts throughout my childhood, and that's understandable. But even as an adult, I tried to get him to tell me those stories because I wanted to know my father. And I wanted to know what made him tick. I wanted to know to crack the code on him. And I knew that it was important, if I was going to do that, to know what happened in Vietnam. And that long nights, late nights in the RV, we could talk about military life. And he was still always sort of, my father's kind of a master at dodging the psychological truths of what's going on. He's a great storyteller,
mm-hmm.
but I think he hides from the emotional realities that are the underpinnings of all great story. And so I was always after those stories in the RV.
But even there, he was no like philosopher king. I mean, a little, grab ass, a little, he was still had that sort of, let's be kind of wild and crazy, son. There's a little bit on 211 that gives a kind of a sense of it. This is one stretch, I guess, you were headed Texas way. And he still wants to get out and whoop it up.
He does. I mean, he's, he wanted to be my friend. And I think that may have been one of his major mistakes as a father was after the failure of his parenting style when I was a kid, then when I was adult, he just wanted to be my friend. You want me to read from the book?
Yeah, if you would.
Yeah, this is near the end of the second RV trip that I took with him, and we were just west of Houston. And after I'd come back from a run where I thought I was going to have a heart attack because it was about 110 degrees out.
That's Houston.
From the pool, I watched my father moving around in his RV. He lived alone in Fairfield, California, and he mostly traveled alone in the RV. I knew that the solitary life he had created for himself fit in well with his fantasies of being a Clint Eastwood character from a Western. The epic wanderer, the stoic, the man who lives on canned beans and shoe leather and the hard-bought realities of the road. But wouldn't my father have been happier if he were in love with a woman and living in a clean and tidy house? I loved my father, and I understood well the allure of this iconic Western fantasy, but the possibility that I might end up like my father, old, alone, and dying, scared the hell out of me as I floated naked on my back in the hotel pool west of Houston. It frightened me so intensely that back in the RV, I told my father that I needed to return to New York as soon as possible to take care of some things. We made it to Lockhart that afternoon and ate barbecue at Kreitz Market. We made it into Austin and drank a few beers at a bar, and my father glared with passion at the college girls who served us. So did I. And in the morning, I flew home.
Anthony Swofford wrote Jarhead. Now he's written Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails, a memoir there, reading for us from New York. Anthony, we've got a lot of people with experience and trails that may crisscross yours a little bit. I want to begin to bring them in. Kilmarnock, Virginia, Elise is calling. Elise, thanks. You're on the air with Anthony Swofford.
Hi, I just wanted to say I admire the caller so much. I had the same type of father. He was a West Point colonel in Korea when I was born, in Vietnam when I was in high school. And it does take practically a whole lifetime to get over that sort of parenting. I mean, the perfectionism, the drinking, the fact that nothing ever is good enough, et cetera, et cetera. I had some real artistic ability, but I couldn't go ahead and pursue that because, you know, artists are not good people. So I became a corporate executive, made my own money, and now finally in my 50s, I'm painting, doing quite well, and pretty happy with it. So I empathize with the author. I can't wait to get the book, and thank you very much.
So, but at least the idea that this flows down for many, many years, flowing through your life, your father's military experience, is one you relate to alongside Anthony.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's sort of like the novel, The Great Santini. There is just a iconic stereotype of the tough military father. People who haven't had that, they just kind of don't understand or don't get it. Most of the time they're alcoholics. Most of the time they're abusive. And it either destroys you or toughens you up.
But it's not. Elise, I appreciate your call so much. Anthony, what do you say to Elise?
Well, I don't know if most of the time they're alcoholics and abusive, but I do know that they live their lives, and because they're very much married to the military and that career, and those careers mean a lot to them, that the intensity of military life and making and fighting war trickles down into families. And I know a lot of military brats. I'm married to a military brat, and the kinds of choices and the kinds of homes that military guys make, they live on for a long time. You know, Elise is in her 50s now, and, mm-hmm. and you could hear in her voice as she was speaking that that boot print of military service that her father's is still very much present in her life.
Elise, thanks for your call. Anthony, where's the line here between fellow feeling, you two, Elise and you, sharing a kind of experience there, and stereotyping? I mean, you know, not everybody's that sort of hard-bitten disciplinarian at home, I presume. And as you say, not everybody's abusive and alcoholic by any means.
No, not at all. And, you know, some guys... you know, return from war, and they're not really touched by it, and others are, and there's no telling who will be touched by it and who won't, and who has the stores of resiliency and who doesn't. I think that probably for the children of career service members, it's a very different home. You know, their entire childhood is marked by military service. So that means moving around a lot and losing friends and a father or mother's, you know, complete dedication to a career. And, you know, military service is not a 9-to-5 job. It's a real life-encompassing career. And, you know, no matter what you do, if you throw that much of your life into it, I think there's going to be a cost at home and a cost to the children.
Jesse in Charleston, South Carolina. Thanks for calling, Jesse. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am also the daughter of a veteran, a World War II veteran. Mm-hmm. My father served in Belgium. My mother had two brothers who were killed during the war, and of course she was very, very afraid for my father, and his love for her came through to me when I was a small child of 4 or 5 years old. And so I understood a lot of why he behaved like he did when he came back. I was 6 when he came back. He was a very stern father. We were whipped for punishment. We would beg mother to whip us with the hairbrush before dad came home if we'd done something wrong, because we didn't want to go through his thing. And he didn't hurt us, but it was you went in the bathroom, you pulled down your underwear, you bent over the toilet, you put your hands up so that they would not be on your back,
yeah.
And that he would only hit you where it wouldn't show on your behind. this was such a production that I, even though he just hit us one or two times, it made such an impression on me.
Terrifying theater.
Oh, now I can remember it.
Yeah.
He was a hard-drinking fella. I particularly remember when a neighbor of ours came over one night, knocked on the door. We were eating supper, and he had his gun in his hand. Well, he was also a veteran, and Dad understood that he was going through post-traumatic shock type thing, and he talked him out of the, sat him down at the kitchen table, brought him a drink, and talked him out of the gun.
Boy, I mean, there are millions of children and relatives around this country, Jesse, Anthony, who have their version of this story. I mean, Anthony, here it is.
Yeah, you let's just be honest. You send people off to go fight wars. They see and sometimes participate in some very heinous things that are really unnatural. And there are going to be some serious psychological costs. And those costs trickle down to the people around them. And I think the last caller's father, men who served in World War II, they came home and they didn't talk about it. And I don't think there was much outreach and much service for those people, many services. And I think that now there's always more room to help veterans. There's always more to do. But I do think that in the last decade, there's been some more aggressive outreach and a more frank talk about the psychological costs of combat and what happens when women and men return home and they have to make sense of what they've done and what they've seen, and they need to go on and live healthy lives here. And that's a challenge.
Jesse, I appreciate your call. How did your father want it? Did he want comradeship? You know, we're both vets. We've both been through it. Or was it really on the personal side that he wanted your, in a way, absolution? Your forgiveness.
He wanted total forgiveness, which I wasn't willing to give right off the bat. It took me a while to come to that. He admitted to me that he wouldn't give a full apology. He would say that if I was raising you today, people would call that child abuse, what I did, which is kind of a half apology. And I don't know that I wanted an apology as much as I just wanted honest talk about what my childhood had been like and the recognition that if we were going to have a healthy relationship moving forward, that we weren't just going to sweep these things under the rug. And again, I have to give my father a lot of credit because, he made the first gesture and he was willing to jump in that Winnebago with me a few more times, knowing that I was still somewhat angry and upset about the past and as well for my own good, wanted to move beyond it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Jarhead author, ex-Marine Anthony Swofford, about life after war and his winding road to peace on his own and with his father. He tells it in a new book, Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails, a memoir. Anthony Swofford joins us from New York. There's an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Anthony, I wanted to play a little bit the scene from the movie version of Jarhead. Jake Gyllenhaal, of course, played your role there as scout sniper. Your partner was D.I. Fitch, played by Peter Sarsgaard, 2005 film. And here's the moment where you and Fitch are about to take your first shot of the war. This was the Gulf War. Swofford had his finger on the trigger. He's about to shoot when air power is called in. His sighting partner is desperate for that first kill, melts down when a senior officer tells them to hold fire.
What difference does it make? We have a perfect shot. Just let us take it.
Negative.
We have permission from the colonel, sir.
Hitman 45. Hitman 45. This is Bravo 4.
God damn it, he's dead anyway. Just let us do it.
You are way out of line, Corporal.
What difference does it make?
Give him back the
hands. If it doesn't make a difference? Why the f*** do you have to do
Because we have the goddamn shots! That's why we're here!
That's why we're here. Anthony Swofford, it took you a long time to get over the fact that you came home from that war without that kill.
It did take me a long time. It really took the writing of Jarhead to come to terms with it and to be relieved by that fact. I had fantasized about it and had wanted it and had felt like I was less of a Marine and even less of a man because I hadn't had that kill. And I do my best thinking while I work, and I think my brain and my heart are best when I'm writing, and it took the writing of that book to come to terms with that fact. Though I was still, I don't know if I'm ashamed of it, but I'm surprised by it. I still kind of wanted it. I'm very much stamped by the United States Marine Corps and the idea of combat and the idea of combat being the most important test of a man. And so even as these last two wars were going on and as I was starting to write this new book that was going to be a book mostly about my father, I still kind of wanted a taste of combat. I spent a lot of time around veterans around the country in the aftermath of Jarhead coming out. And so I spent a lot of time around guys who fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. Mm. And I would be in rooms with them. And I know the language they use, and I know the lingo. And I can step into a room full of Marines and be very comfortable. And I heard their tales of combat, and I felt kind of like the little kid in the room because I didn't have those same tales of combat, and I still kind of wanted them. And I thought that that was going to be, for many years still, I thought that that was going to be the great test of my manhood.
Your war
should be combat.
Such a fast war. These have been long wars. I mean, lots of time with your father, lots of time thinking about the veteran experience. There's also a lot in this book of homecoming and being home about women, lots and lots of women in your life. And lots of duplicity on that front. Where does that come from?
Well, I was a single man in my 30s living in Manhattan, and I was somewhat a product of my time and my place.
But it wasn't just Manhattan. You're in a hotel in Tokyo, and you're juggling three women at one time in one city and literally sort of upstairs, downstairs.
Well, I liked taking risks. Joining the Marine Corps was a risk, and combat is a great risk. And I kept living that way. I'm not proud of it, but it was exciting. Nothing is quite as exciting as combat. And I was after something that might be just as exciting and just as exhilarating. I think that's something that I share with a lot of veterans is that high of combat is really, really hard to replicate. And I tried to replicate it with chancy personal behavior. And I was after that same sort of high and adrenaline rush that combat offers.
Todd in Newport News, Virginia. Thanks for calling, Todd. You're on the air with Anthony Swofford.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well.
My question is for the author. I've recently retired from the Army in the past week. And the way the author has described his father, I was a lot like that. And it wasn't until the past year, 18 months, when I realized it. And I have a 21-year-old son and a 13-year-old daughter. Mm-hmm. Who unfortunately had to live through that. And I wanted to ask the author some of his recommendations on how I can reconnect with my children, because I've been so desperately trying to.
It's a powerful question. I'm a new father. I have a 9-month-old daughter. So I'm new to the game of fatherhood, but I would just tell you to have a really honest conversation with them and apologize for what you need to apologize and try to make them understand that, you were serving your country and that service, unfortunately, seemed to have taken precedence over your role as a father, and ask them for their forgiveness and, you know, I think children need results and they need action and they need behavior and that's really probably the strongest kind of message that you can send them is behaving differently if you think that the way you'd behaved in the past may have harmed your relationship.
Have you tried that, Todd? Are you prepared to?
Oh yeah, I've tried that several times. With my daughter, the ice is starting to melt. It's just been a lot more difficult with my son, who, of course, had to live through it a lot longer than my daughter. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I am trying that, and things are working out. But this is a great show, and I appreciate your guest and your show, Tom.
Well, I appreciate your call, Todd. I mean, if you're earnest about it, if you're sincere about it, I'm sure you can make headway there. We see it in Anthony Swofford's book right here in his own life, and we wish you very good luck with that. Thanks for calling, Todd.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Todd.
Brian, good luck, sir. Brian in Lexington, Kentucky. Brian, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Anthony. There's so much to say, but it's a great conversation. I was a part of one of 48 veterans who recently returned their medals service to the NATO general in Chicago.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was a pretty powerful moment, and I still get kind of choked up about it. But it represents a lot of the pain and the guilt behind all the pride that veterans face every day, whether they served or not, like Anthony said. Mm-hmm. I think that it's hard to describe what needs to happen, but I do a lot of work with veterans who are trying to overcome all these difficulties. It's not political one way or the other, but if we really address all the issues that veterans are facing, there would be very little left of the military, just plain and simple.
What do you mean by that, Brian? What do you mean?
Well, I see veterans every day who now are out, and they're suffering intensely. Either they're on psychotropics, or they're dealing with guilt, or alcohol addiction, or you know anything that Anthony might have described too. But the active duty service members who are showing up for, you know, PT work every day, they have to live with the military environment that isn't exactly very accommodating to their needs, especially mental. It's been said that if you come back from war without PTSD, then you have a disorder. So anybody who goes to war is changed, and the military is not addressing that at the level that it should or that it could, but we are, like you said, pushing in that direction. But I don't think that service members, from what I can tell, know where to go and know what to do.
Brian, there must be many who don't suffer so acutely as well. Or am I wrong? But surely there are.
No, you're right. I was an Apache maintenance mechanic in the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. And I was only mortared and shelled. I didn't shoot at anybody. I didn't get shot at. That's what I always say. But I deal with, like, a lot of anxiety. One of my maintenance teammates tried to commit suicide when he came back. People go into war with all sorts of different mental conditions before they even enter the military or war. And so it has to be addressed like that. You can't just say, well, you went to Vietnam or you went to Iraq, therefore you must be treated with A, B, or C.
Yeah.
Military is not very individualized. It's very standardized. And we're not treating soldiers like individuals. We're treating them like parts of the whole.
I guess that's inevitable. I appreciate your work with veterans, Brian, and it's good to hear from you today from Lexington, Kentucky. If I may, Anthony, let me get one more call right here. I'll put them both to you. But this is another Anthony calling from East Boston. Anthony, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you see?
Well, Tom, I'm one of those veterans that you mentioned earlier who haven't had the degenerative effects of war. I served 10 years in the Marines. I went to both Iraq and Afghanistan. And I caution some listeners to take Mr. Swofford's word at full tilt. I know that the Marine does stamp Marines and that the Marine Corps also does give us a taste for combat that is hard to lose once you get out of the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
But when Mr. Swofford used the words brainwashing at the beginning, and I remember one phrase from his book, Jarhead, he said, every real Marine hates the Corps. It makes the Marine Corps or the military in general seem like it's a factory, if you will, that stamps out machines and then lets them rust away after they're done. And for me, at least, the Marine Corps has given me a discipline, a work ethos, ethics, moral compass, and other things that I've taken into civilian life. And I hope Mr. Swofford realizes that, at least for some veterans.
I'd like to hear you two address that. Anthony Swofford, what do you say to Anthony East Boston?
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of I learned discipline in the Marine Corps, and it helps me in my daily life as a writer. Chesty Puller, the most famous Marine ever, his son, Lewis Puller Jr., wrote a book. His legs were blown off in Vietnam, and he wrote one of the most powerful Vietnam novels called Fortunate Son. And near the end of it, he says that the same thing that I said, that when you love the Marine Corps and you also hate the Marine Corps, and but you always love Marines, and I always love Marines, and you know, I understand that the institution does some things to Marines that changes them. It also trains some young men who go off and use those skills. And like I said before, you never know who's resilient and who isn't. It sounds like Anthony was incredibly resilient and has left the Marine Corps and uses those skills in his civilian life, and I think that's great. But we need to be realistic as well about what happens to many young men. The prior caller to Anthony works with veterans who mm-hmm. have difficulty transitioning back to the civilian world. And it's not uncommon that people have difficulty in that transition. And that's not really the Marine Corps' fault or the Army's fault. But I think that there can always be more done for the veteran.
You know, it's so, Anthony in East Boston, I appreciate your call. This is so interesting. I mean, on the one hand, when a country goes to war and goes to war repeatedly, you must look at the cost to everybody here, and particularly those who served and come home. But then it's kind of a minefield, Anthony Swofford. You don't want to stereotype people. You don't want to divide them good, bad, resilient, not resilient. People are going to respond in all different kinds of ways to war. Your dad came back and was a tough father, but there's all kinds that come back. Here's Kate writes to us, so this is from Nashville. She says, not all military fathers are as cruel as the examples that have been offered. My father was a captain in the Army, an engineer, a wonderful man, never ran our family like his platoon. When he was home, he wasn't Captain Tom. He was an encouraging, loving dad. She writes, my grandfather saw action under Patton in World War II. While he wouldn't speak about the horrors he'd seen in war, he was, along with her father, one of the most influential and inspirational male figures in my life. Set the gold standard for the way a man should conduct himself in life. It's not as though somebody used the word, of factory stamping out parts here. It's not as though all parts come out in one mold, Anthony Swofford.
No, they don't. I never suggest that. Mm-hmm. But I do suggest that we need to be realistic about what we ask of young men and women who serve and who go to war, and be realistic about what happens when they come back and the challenges. War changes people mightily. It just does. If you think it doesn't, you're foolish. It's a place where morals are up in the air, and if there's a Dr. Jonathan Shea, who's a Bostonian, who's written brilliantly about veterans and combat, and he talks of something called a moral injury that can happen at combat. And if it does, it doesn't happen to everyone. For some people, they serve and the war is conducted exactly as it should be. But for others, it doesn't happen that way. And this moral injury that Dr. Shea talks about can occur, and it takes a lot of work, and it takes diligence on the veteran's behalf. It also takes diligence on the people who are here to serve vets and to get over that. And all I'm asking for is mm-hmm. A realistic look at what happens. And my return from war is not like every other Marine's return from war, and I'm happy for that. And I'm happy for the woman who had a grandfather and father who it sounds like were great men and great fathers. But that's not always the case.
You've got a wife now and a baby daughter that we can read your deep fondness, love for. And that's great. What about with your dad after all the road trips? Where did that relationship come to?
You know, my father and I sit in a room together and we share stories and what my father calls fellowship. And, you know, at the end of our second trip, we were in the RV together and we were happy. And shortly after that, I brought my newborn daughter to meet my father, and she sat on his lap. And for me, the circle is closed. I'm no longer just a son. I'm a father myself, and I'm moving forward as a father.
Anthony Swofford, author of Jarhead, now of Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails, a memoir. Anthony, thanks so much for being with us today. Good luck to you and to your family.
Thanks, Tom. Thank you very much. My pleasure.
And a program note today, if you're in Boston next week, come by and see us. June 14th at the Paramount Center, we'll be taping a live show, live audience, On Point Live, we call it. Environmental Bigfoot Bill McKibben will be there, musical guest Martin Sexton, Jack Beatty. Good conversation and a lot of fun live. June 14th, On Point Live, all the details at onpointradio.org. We'd love to see you there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.